From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. 18 miles of I-85 could be an on-ramp to the future. The Ray C. Anderson Memorial Highway, or the Ray, stretches from West Point to LaGrange, Georgia. It is now a proving ground for technologies that make infrastructure more ecologically sustainable, ideas modeled by its namesake, carpet manufacturer who was once called the greenest CEO. So how would it work? Well, Allie Kelly is overseeing several related projects as executive director of the Ray, and she's one of the speakers featured at TEDx Atlanta this Friday. Allie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for being here. What does sustainable highway mean?
That was the exact question that we had about 4 years ago when we started this journey on the Ray. We worked with Georgia Tech at the very beginning to try to understand how we might be able to transform an 18-mile stretch of highway into a place, into a status that better reflected the life and the legacy of Ray Anderson. What we quickly found is that our stretch of interstate is just like every other mile of interstate in the United States. And that's how we have decided to work with the Ray C. Anderson Foundation, with Georgia DOT, with partners at the Federal Highway Administration and U.S. DOT, and with partners in the private sector and advanced technology firms and companies that have a stake in transportation, to use this 18-mile stretch as a demonstration area to transform every mile of interstate across the country and around the world.
There are so many players and so much involved when doing something with a highway. Then, as you said, Georgia, the GDOT is in charge of state and federal roadways. So how did your organization get control, I guess, of this stretch?
Oh, I don't think we have control. We work in a partnership. It's an expansion of the P3, the public-private partnership. We've added philanthropy, so we've created the P4, public-private philanthropic partnership. And using our resources, using our expertise and the expertise of our partners, we combine those resources with Georgia DOT and with the federal government to make these demonstrations happen. We're one of only two areas in the United States where active roadway is being used to demonstrate and to test technology that's ready for prime time, that's ready for an open and public environment. And our hope is that as the technology performs and as it succeeds, that we can help to scale it to other states and to other parts of the country.
Well, so let's look at that technology a little bit. Among the initiatives, converting this section of the highway into a solar highway. So what does that mean?
Sure. Well, the mission and the goals of the Ray revolve around saving lives, decarbonizing transportation, and taking the waste in the transportation sector and creating more productivity, turning liabilities into assets. And there's a lot of transportation infrastructure and assets that we've already invested in that are already built and functioning, but they're only functioning with one purpose. They're single use. And really, we live in a multitasking world. And so the question is, you know, these pieces of infrastructure, could they do more than one thing?
Mm-hmm. More than just provide transportation from one place to the next.
Right. So the travel lane itself, on the interstate system, we clear 40 feet or more on either side. Mm-hmm. And that means that the travel lane is completely exposed to sunlight unless it's shaded by an immediately passing car or truck. So what we did is in 2016, we worked with a French company called Wattway to install a 50 square meter test section of solar pavement. We didn't have to change anything about the existing road. The solar pavement actually adheres to the existing road, so you don't have to throw away any of your existing infrastructure. It just actually unlocks new potential and unlocks new performance out of an existing asset. In the first 12 months, ours was the highest producing test section of solar road in the entire world. We produced enough power in 12 months to power the average American house. And so then the question becomes, who would like their driveway to power their house?
Sounds like a good deal to me. But the theme of your TEDx talk, is a futuristic transportation, which makes, you know, me think of jetpacks and Blade Runner. So of all the things needing attention to make the planet sustainable enough for generations to live on, why highways?
Well, why highways? Because the governor, Governor Deal, worked with Ray Anderson's youngest daughter, Harriet Anderson Langford, in 2011 to designate a stretch of highway that we now are able to use as a proving ground. But also, why highways? Because transportation is going through immense disruption. We've seen this before. You know, at the start of the 20th century, we went from the horse and buggy to the motor car. And then in the 1950s, we went from the motor car to the American two-car family, which was gas-powered. And now we're moving into an electrified transportation environment that's smart, becoming smarter, and that will, in short order, drive itself, you know, self-driving autonomous electric vehicles. And we have to figure out how the infrastructure is going to not only accommodate advanced mobility, cars that are electric and cars that are autonomous self-driving, but also how can our infrastructure be improved and how can the infrastructure become smart so that we can leverage the highest benefits out of advanced mobility. And what I mean by leveraging the highest benefits, that might be congestion mitigation or efficiencies in freight. It might be saving human lives, which we need desperately because nearly 40,000 Americans are dying on our roads every year. And also, we need desperately to decarbonize transportation in the United States. It's the largest contributing sector to carbon emissions. And those are our opportunities to match smart infrastructure with advanced mobility as these advanced vehicles are introduced into our fleet.
I'm speaking with Allie Kelly. She's executive director of the RAE. It's an 18-mile stretch of I-85 from LaGrange to West Point, Georgia, and it's become a testing ground for sustainable highway technologies. Are you, Allie, you mentioned working with a French company, for the most part, working with existing technologies, or actually is the RAE developing its own?
The RAE is actually developing its own technology as well. It's a road dot that would replace the existing reflector dots on the road. Mm-hmm. The road dot that we're developing is LED lit, capable of communicating via color through amber lights or white lights or red lights. It's a smart device, so it gives the road a voice and allows the road to know itself and communicate out what its status is, which could be really important in terms of understanding how weather is affecting driving conditions or if there's an accident up ahead, trying to get approaching motorists to slow down or maybe warning you that you're approaching a work site so that you could be more aware of your driving and more aware of your surroundings. So we're working on our own technology as a philanthropy, but we also are constantly looking for new companies and new technologies to work with. You know, they have to meet the criteria of the Georgia DOT and the RAE, which are to save lives, to increase efficiency, to mitigate congestion, and to reduce carbon. So those are the mission and the criteria that you have to meet. And it has to be something that's going to be safe in its operation. It cannot disturb the operation of the existing system because we're not on a private test track. We're not tucked away in someone's backyard. We're on a high-speed interstate, 70 miles per hour mixed fleet with heavy 18-wheelers as well as, you know, four-door sedans that are carrying families from vacation to work or whatever. So
if somebody is driving along, does it look different? Would drivers actually know, I'm on the RAE, this is all new?
Yeah, it's becoming more and more visible with every year. This year, Georgia Power will be working with the RAE, Georgia DOT, and the feds and other partners to build a megawatt of solar off to the shoulder of the interstate. So 40 feet from the edge of the interstate pavement, you will find 2,600 solar panels with native wildflowers growing underneath them. We'll be the third state in the country to pilot the utilization of government-owned right-of-way for the production of clean, renewable energy. We'll start with solar energy this year, and then our hope is that we can also demonstrate how wind energy might be developed and generated in the transportation sector using transportation wind.
Mm-hmm. So the force of the, you mean the force of the car?
The force of 18-wheelers going under bridge overpasses where the wind energy is really pinched is an opportunity for us here in Georgia where otherwise our wind resources are not that great.
Huh. Highways are usually eyesores. So the idea of you're talking about actually transforming the land around and planting wild grasses and flowers?
We actually have the only pilot on the interstate right-of-way of a new cultivar of wheat developed by the Land Institute. It's a perennial wheat called Kernza. And one of the great things about Kearns is that it grows 9 to 10 foot root systems that bury atmospheric carbon deep into the soil underneath the topsoil where it could be re-released. This plant actually buries it 9 feet, 10 feet below. And our thought is that if this plant is able to survive in the southeast on the right-of-way where the soil is pretty polluted and degraded, that we might be able to work with Georgia DOT and the Federal Highway Administration and farmers to think about, you know, possibly harvesting the wheat for a sustainable fiber product that a company like Kimberly-Clark could use in making toilet tissue or baby diapers.
You've really thought a lot of this stuff.
Everything has multiple purposes because it, you know, we have a lot of opportunity with technology and innovation to make our transportation sector work a little harder and produce better results for us. Another really easy thing that we could be doing across the state and across the country is the utilization of scrap tires into the pavement. And so we're excited this year we're going to be repaving 13 of the 18 miles with Georgia DOT and the Federal Highway Administration and C.W. Matthews as the contracting partner. And we will have a test section of rubberized asphalt, which is scrap tires.
Which you can't do anything with, really.
Directly into the pavement.
Wow.
It produces a really superior paving surface that's quieter, that's safer, it handles water differently. It also has nearly double the lifespan, so you can get twice of the life out of your infrastructure with each paving. I think it's really going to produce some amazing results for the Ray that will open other people's eyes as to how we can find sustainable end markets for what is otherwise a really dangerous waste product like scrap tires.
So what is the cost per mile compared to a standard highway? Have you worked that out yet?
We have been working with groups from Duquesne University to try to understand the cost-benefit analysis of investing in these technologies and the benefits that it produces, whether it's clean energy or a longer lifespan or safer roads. And that all of that information can be found on our website, which is www.theray.org. You know, the problem that we have, and I think that we're going to have to confront in short order, is that everything that we do in transportation, by and large, is based on low bid on day one. Mm-hmm. And the analysis really needs to become more of a life cycle that can take into account the benefits of investing in smarter infrastructure 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later. So that's a conversation that the federal government is involved in and our state government. And we hope we can be a driver in that conversation, no pun intended.
Have you looked to expand to other communities beyond this stretch from LaGrange?
We do. We have an existing 3-year partnership with the Colorado DOT's RoadX program. We'll soon be announcing partnerships with Tollway Authority in Pennsylvania, and also here in Georgia, we'll soon be announcing a partnership, strategic partnership between the Ray and Peachtree Corners in Gwinnett County.
So this is something I might think of, you know, happening in California or Massachusetts. I mean, are people surprised when you're working on this in Georgia?
People are excited that that philanthropy can be leveraged in a P4 to build infrastructure, especially when we've had gridlock nationally in focusing on infrastructure. We have infrastructure week every year, but we don't have an infrastructure bill or an infrastructure funding plan yet. Philanthropy can come to the table and we can build infrastructure and we can make transportation safer and smarter. And this is probably a plan for the future because, you know, right now our transportation and infrastructure is largely funded by the gas tax. And as we move into electrified mobility, we're going to have to find other ways to partner to fund smarter infrastructure.
Well, Allie Kelly, thank you so much for speaking with us this morning.
Thank you.
And break a leg at your TEDx talk.
Thank you.
Executive Director of the Ray. That's the name of the nonprofit. It's an 18-mile stretch of I-85 from LaGrange to West Point. Coming up, too many cars on the road? Try walking or biking. Unfortunately, a lot of accidents. We'll find out why. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Collisions involving cars, pedestrians, and bicycles are on the rise across the U.S., including in Georgia. The Atlanta Regional Commission reported a 53% jump in such collisions in Metro Atlanta between 2006 and 2015, when some 2,500 were reported in the 20-county metro region. The number of serious injuries or deaths over that time went up by 26%. Thomas Wheatley is articles editor for Atlanta Montana Magazine, and he reported on the issue for the magazine. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. That's a little staggering. 26% increase in serious injuries and fatalities tied to these collisions. How much of this is attributed to distracted driving by people looking at their phones?
Well, distracted driving, it plays a role. There are a lot of factors at play, however. One is population growth. There are more people, so more people are driving. Another is in a good economy, more people drive, more people have to go to work, more people are moving goods. But a big factor, a lot of experts say, it has to do with just the roads that we drive on, the way that they're designed, and especially the roads in Sunbelt states, including Georgia, which are really known for sprawl. We build roads that kind of take us further and further out, farther and farther out, and the main design factor in those is just moving people as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm. So they're designed for speed. In fact, that was probably one of the most disturbing things that I saw in your article. Rebecca Cerna, she's executive director of the Atlanta Bicycle Coalition, told you our streets are dangerous by design.
Yes.
And now, mind you, she's an advocate for cycling. But is that how it's looked at overall?
Yes, very much so. And especially among advocates like Cerna, like Sally Flocks from PEDS, which is a pedestrian safety organization that does a lot of work in this area as well. Roads are really designed, especially roads in Metro Atlanta, they're more designed for automobiles. They're not as much designed for people walking or people on bicycles. Not to say that planners do not care about those people, but oftentimes when you're looking at these roads, you're making cost cuts. You're thinking, okay, what do we need to do to kind of get this to the finish line? And it's all about, okay, how can we move more cars?
Right. I often see there are no sidewalks in many, many places in Atlanta's roadways or streets, certainly not bike lanes. But what happens here, it seems, is that, you know, while share the road may be the tagline, you find some examples of resistance, initiatives that effectively pit drivers against pedestrians and cyclists. What are some examples of those that you came up with?
Well, one of them is there was a battle on over Peachtree Road over restriping it a few years back, and GDOT had proposed putting in bike lanes, and that was met with a lot of resistance, especially from people who lived in the area, and they argued that it was going to cause traffic to back up, it was going to frustrate drivers, and it was going to send drivers onto residential side streets to try to bypass the gridlock. Mm-hmm. And with innovations like Waze and all these other apps, you hear that complaint more and more that, you know, my sleepy, quiet side street is now a cut through for everybody driving from Cobb and elsewhere to get to their office. There was such a bitter dispute over that that they eventually, you know, scuttled the bike lane, GDOT did. And another example is DeKalb Avenue, where if you live in Atlanta and you drive on DeKalb Avenue, it really is kind of the city's craziest street. There's the, unfortunately, you know, named suicide lane. People travel at high speeds. It's not really a great place to walk or to bike. And there have been discussions for years over what to do with that street. And I always love covering these meetings because passions are so high. I mean, these are some of the best community meetings to cover because people really care about this. And you have two very clear sides saying, I want this, I want that. But the answer is really kind of in between.
As it often is.
And we need both.
Well, there are some notoriously problematic spots. You mentioned DeKalb Avenue, especially in Metro Atlanta. In 2016, Alexia Heineman, she was a freshman at Grady High School, struck by a motorist while riding her bike in 2016. This was at the intersection of 10th Street and Monroe Drive, and she later died. So students from Grady High School are still rallying to improve this intersection, this Complete Streets programs. What is a Complete Streets program and how would that help?
Complete Streets programs really kind of look at a street for all users. How do you make it a street where it's safe to walk, it's safe to bike, it's safe to drive? We all pay for these streets, so we should all be able to use them. So think about like protected bike lanes, wide sidewalks, good lighting, crosswalks, maybe special signals at intersections that might be that might be more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a complete street is. It's kind of a beautiful thing if you're a wonk because it's something that everybody can use and everybody can feel safe using. We need more of those in Atlanta. Atlanta is a city that is really retrofitting itself from being a city where people were leaving in the 70s and 80s and before that to a place where people are now coming back in very large numbers. And what worked back then is not working now.
Mm-hmm. So, but what about the cost for something like that? Installing more streetlights, creating bike lanes, beside the fact that you're taking away room from drivers.
Well, I mean, you know, bike lanes can run. You know, it depends on what you want. Tactical urbanists have done some really cool things with just putting up planters separating traffic from bikes. You know, you can have a protected bike lane for about $30,000 a mile, I think, and then it can go up. I mean, if you want to have like the Rolls Royce of bike lanes, someone can do it for you. A lot of times, those can be, you know, a fraction of a road project. And sometimes it's just, you know, like small things can do a lot. The issue becomes when, you know, we do things with city money like building a pedestrian bridge over Northside Drive.
For the Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
For the Mercedes-Benz Stadium that was supposed to be used for the Super Bowl, and then it was closed for the Super Bowl until after the game. And when really you can do some pedestrian fixes on Northside Drive for just kind of a fraction of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about, I mean, talking with advocates, it's all about your priorities. And if you want to do something about it, you can budget the money for it.
Yeah. But of course, that means who's got the political power, who's got the ear of those who are in power to do that kind of thing. And how's that stacking up? Are these organizations like PEDS or Rebecca Cerner's organization, are they making a real difference?
They are. They definitely are. I mean, they have a lot of political power behind them, especially in the city, because it might be, while you might not be a avid bicyclists or bicyclist, or you might not be a really kind of gung-ho pedestrian, I suppose, but it's one of those things that once you notice it's an issue, a lot of people are on board with this, and there's a way to do it by respecting drivers and respecting bicyclists and respecting pedestrians. Yeah, so I think they definitely have power.
But one of the things that you found is that people are pedestrians at some point in their commute, right? That maybe they're not going all the way by foot, but some part of them is winding up on foot. Do you think there's, I don't know, there needs to be a rethink about, like, we're all pedestrians at some point.
Yeah, at some point we are. And especially if we want to live in the city, we're going to be pedestrians more and more. I believe it's something like 75% of all transit trips start with, you know, you start on your feet. We have to be thinking about how are we going to get around our city in a safe way.
Mm. Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Thomas Wheatley. He's articles editor for Atlanta Magazine, and he recently reported in the magazine on the rise of pedestrian and bicycle collisions in Atlanta and some efforts to change that. Well, I imagine if you have a bunch of high school kids rallying, that gets a lot of attention, certainly. So what have city officials and planners actually done to try and change things?
Well, this is definitely on the city's it's definitely on the city's radar. The transportation plan has this concept that was started in Sweden called Vision Zero that's kind of baked into the transportation plan. So there are a lot of plans for complete streets around the city. There's a lot of focus on, and this is really interesting, that I believe it's something like 6% of the city's roads are responsible for, I believe, 71% of the traffic-related fatalities.
Wow.
And 42% of the injuries, and that was between 2012 to 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So they can focus on those areas. They can also, you know, commit to the funding that they have available. We have the Renew Atlanta Infrastructure Bond Package that's going to be paying for a lot of these programs. There is some activity now where they're looking at the project costs because that money's not going as far as they hoped it would. So they can stick to this. You have a lot of city officials who really care about this. Tim Keene in the city planning department cares about it. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms on the campaign trail, she said that this was something that she wanted to pay attention to. So it's definitely happening in the city. I think it's happening elsewhere in Metro Atlanta. It's just that I believe in the suburbs, it can be rather difficult because these were places that were designed really for automobile traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And as time goes on and you see trends of more and more poverty in the suburbs, there's going to be a need for more transit. There's going to be a need for more sidewalks for people who might not be able to own a car for them to get around. So it's a bit of a heavier lift.
Well, you talked a little bit about the population increase earlier in Atlanta. Of course, there's been a huge move to get people to have walkable cities, you know, people to be able to bicycle or scooters. How are scooters, by the way, fitting into this? They seem to have been a bane in the municipal, at least if you were looking at regulatory.
Yeah, what I find really interesting about scooters is that they have kind of showed us just through how people use them and people's behavior, how we're lacking in a lot of these kind of like pedestrian and bicycle facilities.
Mm-hmm.
If scooters had like protected bike lanes to travel on, I really think they would be using those more than sidewalks.
Mm.
You know, I mean, the fact that people are using sidewalks tells us that the city streets are not safe, that they really fear going down Peachtree or Piedmont Road and somebody's roaring behind them. So, I mean, I don't have any hard numbers on how many injuries have been caused by them or anything like that. But it's definitely like a new wrinkle in this whole debate.
So we have so many people. The success of the Beltline has shown that people want to be on bikes. They want to be on foot. Do you think that they're working there because they don't work on the streets of Atlanta? Is there something going on there?
Yeah. I mean, because the Beltline just feels safe. You don't feel like you're kind of taking your life into your hands.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel like you're slaloming through people sometimes. And there are some, you know, crazy people on bikes and you know, just crazy people walking. But it's definitely a sign that people want this. And we can't have a Beltline on every street, but we can have a place that gives you that same feeling.
There are a couple points that you brought up in the article that I really wanted to key in on. One is that oftentimes when we hear about a collision, you know, a driver says, I couldn't see the person. You know, it was dark or they came from nowhere or they weren't using a crosswalk. So we often get these things from the perspective of the driver. We're
right.
Very sort of driver focused. But you also got plenty of clapback, I guess, for
yeah.
advocating that pedestrians and cyclists need to learn how to share the road, too. What did you hear from both sides?
Well, and people made a very good point that that I was putting the burden on the people without power, and that is a solid criticism. And I'm of the perspective that people, yes, you need to know the rules of the road. You need to know that you shouldn't jump out in the street in random times, and you need to kind of you need to give drivers signals. But drivers also really need to be aware that they're operating this massive vehicle. And more people are operating larger, massive vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, SUVs are some of the biggest selling automobiles right now. And an SUV in a pedestrian fatality or a pedestrian collision is the injuries are much higher, much more severe. That we all need to really be thinking about how we're going to use this public asset. Everybody wants to get home, you know, but at what cost?
Right. So is there a difference? You were talking about, you know, how beautiful the streets could look and how the city is behind it, at least some segments. But is there a difference between a must-have investment here and this would be nice as far as city planners are concerned?
That's a great question. I really don't know the answer to that. There's a renewed focus at the city on equity. Which has been a long time coming, but it's good to hear. A lot of the places where we're seeing a lot of these injuries and fatalities are happening in areas where there traditionally hasn't been much investment, and they're happening in areas like the west side of Atlanta, where you have a lot of people who don't own a car, who are one of those people who are making those, you know, they start their transit trips by walking to the bus stop or walking to MARTA. It would be really good and just for those investments to happen there. But you have to balance it out in terms of political power, in terms of cost. So I would not want to be in their shoes. it's just not fun.
Not in a car town. Thomas Wheatley, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Wheatley is articles editor for Atlanta Magazine. He recently covered the rise in pedestrian and bicycle collisions in Metro Atlanta. And we're going to leave you with the Athens-based musician Lingua Franca and her song Gold Bike, as we remind you that you can always join our Facebook group and have conversations about the things that we talk about on the show. We'd love to hear your feedback. We'd love to hear if you are a biker and you feel like, well, drivers just don't pay attention. Or if you're a driver and you're sick of navigating the road and don't think, given the notoriously bad traffic of Atlanta, we need to give up more space for cyclists. So coming up, Georgia has the highest rate of new HIV infections per population. So how promising is President Trump's proposal to end its transmission? I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for more of that on Second Thought. Cars to be priceless jewels, but it's incredible what some pedaling exercise will do to tighten up your thighs and glutes. As if my derriere could be any more recognizable. I seen you staring at my derriere when I'm riding through. Or was you staring at my fairy glittered chariot like Harriet the Spy? From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. TEDx Atlanta is this Friday. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with one of the scheduled TED Talkers, Trish Miller. Learn how she's diving into swim safety and helping families learn how to swim through her nonprofit. Please do join us for that tomorrow. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data find that Georgia leads the nation in the rate of new HIV infections proportionate to the population. The problem is especially severe in Metro Atlanta. So health advocates here really sat up when President Trump vowed to address the problem during his State of the Union speech.
My budget will ask Democrats and Republicans to make the needed commitment to eliminate the HIV epidemic in the United States within 10 years.
In fact, Metro Atlanta is among the areas the White House is targeting for its HIV plan. Dr. Carlos Del Rio works at the School of Public Health at the Emory School of Medicine. He's chair of the Department of Global Health and professor of epidemiology and also co-director of the Emory Center for AIDS Research in the studio to tell us more. Welcome, Carlos.
Hey, Virginia, how are you?
Well, thank you so much for being with us, because this is an issue that I think a lot of things, for a lot of people, falls under the radar. So help us get a sense of the problem in Georgia. How many people have HIV or AIDS here?
Well, what you said is exactly right. I think HIV we've forgotten about it, but it's not gone. And I think this new initiative is allowing us to, again, think about the importance of HIV. We in Georgia have a particularly serious problem. In the state of Georgia, there are about 56,000 or so people living with HIV, of which 32,000, almost 33,000 of them are in Metro Atlanta, and a good 16,000 of them are in Fulton County. So you can really see where the epidemic is concentrated. And when you think about new diagnoses in 2017, they were roughly 2,600 in the state of Georgia, of which there were about, of those, about 1,400 were in the city of Atlanta, and about 600 were in Fulton County. So what are the characteristics? Well, the people infected and living with HIV are mostly men. About 80% are men, and about 70% are Black or African American. So you start thinking about, and many of them living in poverty. So you start thinking about this as being an epidemic of disparities. It's affecting racial disparities. It's impacting more the poor than the wealthy. It's affecting people that, lack education, housing, have food insecurity. So again, when we think about HIV, we got to think about social determinants of health. We got to think about all those other things that are leading to HIV. It's not just the virus. It's all the additional factors that really drive the epidemic.
So given that it's a systemic problem, and given that scope, how realistic is President Trump's pledge to end HIV transmission by 2030?
So the good news is that the science is there. In other words, we know two things that are critically important. We know that if people are diagnosed with HIV and are started antiretroviral therapy and they take their medications regularly and their virus gets suppressed, not only do they live healthy lives, nearly normal lives, like somebody who doesn't have HIV, but they also effectively stop transmitting HIV. People who are infected and on therapy and suppressed do not transmit HIV. We know that. So clearly, by treating people, we're also preventing transmission. But we also know that you can give medications. You can give a drug called Truvada, one of the HIV medicines that includes two medications, to people who are at risk and not infected, and that prevents them from acquiring HIV. That's called PrEP. So again, treatment is prevention, and therefore getting people on therapy, if we could find everybody infected, put them on therapy, and suppress their virus, we would stop transmission. The science is there. The challenge is, how do we go from the science to the implementation of the reality? And that's where the leap is. The reality is very different. The reality talks about a lot of challenges. And as I said, it is the social determinants of health that are really, we cannot address ending AIDS without expanding Medicaid, without giving people access to care. We cannot think about ending AIDS without giving people affordable housing, without creating employment, without giving jobs. So really is addressing the whole package, right? And again, that would not only make HIV better. We got to think that here in Georgia, we also have many other health problems. The other day, I was just hearing that you, in this program, in this station, you were talking about maternal mortality. We have one of the highest maternal mortalities in the country. So addressing social determinants of health would have benefits beyond HIV.
All right. What I want to dig into some of the things that you said here. The president's budget today, that's due out today, proposing $291 million in 2020 funding for his initiative to end HIV transmissions. However, critics say the administration's policies toward HIV to date have actually hindered efforts to end the epidemic. What's behind that criticism?
Well, behind that criticism are policies like, you know, the ban on transgender in the military, the continuous, policies that make people who have, who are gay and lesbian and transsexual not feel welcome in this country. The fact that he has ended many programs that help people that are at risk of HIV. So I think there are many policy decisions, his continuous desire to end the Affordable Care Act. So again, we have a lot of policy decisions that are exactly causing the epidemic to get worse, not better. I think the initiative is very welcome. But again, I would tell you I was disappointed to see the budget. $291 million is good. It's nice to have that as a start. But quite frankly, it's a drop in the book. I think about how much money we would need to end the epidemic in Metro Atlanta, I'm thinking about $291 million. So as long as that money all comes to Atlanta, we would be fine. But if we're going to spread that across the United States and pretend we're going to end up the HIV epidemic with 291 additional million, it's really incredible.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's likely to happen. Also, you mentioned PrEP. This is Truvada, HIV prevention pill. The problem is that half the people who need treatment aren't getting it. Now, this is, last figures I saw, $1,700 for a 30-day supply. Is there a plan to cover that cost, or how have people covered it?
Well, in many places it has been covered by insurance. In many places it has been covered by the pharmaceutical company expanded access program and by a patient assistance program. But I think the PrEP has now received a grade A recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. And by doing that, then Medicaid has to cover PrEP. And again, if we don't have Medicaid expansion, we are limited in our ability to provide PrEP in the state of Georgia. And we desperately need to increase the amount of people, the number of people who are in PrEP in this state.
Well, more than 94% of U.S. patients on therapy take one of several HIV drugs invented by Emory scientists. So what are some of the challenges associated with translating the science into programs?
Again, there are many challenges in translating. This is called implementation, right? And a lot of it has to do with how do we take what we know and apply it. We've done actually very well in HIV. And quite frankly, I think I would say we have done much better in HIV overseas than here. At the recent conference in Seattle at CROI, we heard the results of a study called a PopArt. They went to people's houses, they got them HIV tested, they got them to care, they got them on therapy. And when they did that, they were able to decrease transmission of HIV incidence by 30%. We're not doing that in the United States. So there are a lot of lessons from the global epidemic that we, if we could apply locally, we would get much more further than we are actually.
Well, the global story last week was that this so-called London patient, the second person to have gone into long-term remission from HIV after a stem cell transplant. Now, this was hailed as a cure, although many health professionals say that is overblown. What do you think, and what kind of promise is
there? Well, from a scientific perspective, it's great, but it doesn't have implementation. There's no way to make this something that you can make available. You know, we've cured two people. There are 35 million still to go, and there's no way we're going to cure them with bone marrow transplants. So I think about the bone marrow transplant, the London patient or the Berlin patient. I think about it as I think about when John Glenn first went to space. It was a great advance in science and how do we get to space. But we're not all traveling going to space yet, right?
Right. Okay, so we mentioned some zip codes in Atlanta, really, really high rates of HIV, AIDS, 6 to 8 times higher than the national average. Obviously, implementation means education. What are some of the big challenges or ways around that have worked in other places? You mentioned going from house to house. Unlikely to happen here. On a broad scale, what might be some ways to chip away at that?
I think the first one is really to end the stigma associated with HIV. And I think that stigma is the enemy of public health. Dr. Redfield, the director of CDC, says that, and I love it. So we have to address stigma. Stigma is a critical component of what is driving the epidemic and what is preventing people from staying in care and getting care. I think we also have to address other important social determinants of health, like racism, like homophobia. I think, you know, again, a lot of those issues are things that we can address and that we have to think about as a nation about how we're going to confront them, because we're not going to end the epidemic if we don't confront those components.
What are you and your colleagues at Emory, some of the things that they're thinking about? Where's the next direction to go for AIDS, preventing AIDS transmission and healing people or bringing them into remission?
Well, I mean, the first is that we cannot do it alone. We have to work with the health departments. We have to work with the state. We have to work with the community. Most importantly, we have to work with people living with HIV and people at risk of HIV. So it's really creating that group of individuals, that task force, that everybody working together trying to end the epidemic and then listening. There's a lot of it's not what I want to do, but what the community needs and what the community is looking for. And then we have to make priorities. We are very lucky that in Fulton County, we have already a process in place. There's a task force that was put together at Fulton County that planned for addressing the HIV epidemic in the county. And now there's an advisory committee. So I think we're making a lot of progress in Fulton. We still have a long way to go in DeKalb, in Cobb, and Gwinnett. But again, I'm hopeful that with the appointment of Dr. Kathleen Toomey as the director of the Department of Public Health by the governor, and again, Kathleen is starting today, I'm hopeful that the state can play a bigger role in really being the convener and driving this plan to end HIV.
Dr. Carlos Del Rio from the Emory School of Medicine, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Delighted to be here.
He's also co-director of the Emory Center for AIDS Research. And we would love for you to join the conversation. We've talked about several things today, creating more sustainable highways, looking at the long-term costs versus the short-term costs, creating more walkable cities and towns across Georgia. Again, looking at long-term versus short-term costs. What are your arguments for and against those? You can go to our Facebook group. It's GBB Radio's On Second Thought. And we're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can also email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. And you can go old school and leave us a message. We're at 404-500-9457. We've been talking about HIV today, and it has been more than 3 decades since the Food and Drug Administration approved zidovudine, or AZT, as an effective drug to combat HIV and AIDS. Caleb Anderson knows firsthand what it's like to live with the disease. He's studying DePaul University in Indiana and commented on his experience back in 2017.
I remember the day I found out. My mom quivered over the phone. She said, "The pediatrician wants you to come to the office immediately." My stomach felt like it was being flushed down the toilet. I had a routine physical the week before. The doctor noticed swollen lymph nodes around my neck and in my groin area. I felt dizzy standing up for more than 30 seconds. So we returned to the doctor's office after the call back. Changing in front of my mother that day seemed worse than any other day. First my hat, shirt, pants, and underwear. Every layer making me more vulnerable and accountable for whatever the news would be. I could see my mother and even my doctor, too, were on edge of erupting with emotion. I was forced to be strong for them. In tears, who has time for that? The doctor said my test came back positive for HIV. My mother broke into tears. Everything felt colder and I couldn't move, not even my face. My mind sped back to those nights of lust. I remembered every house, hotel, and condo I'd visited during the past 2 years. I had been trying to cope with my actions without being accountable for them. Now, I couldn't escape. That realization numbed me. Remembering every man I gave my body to consolidated my stillness. I was diagnosed less than 2 months before I was set to start college. Large doses of penicillin made it hard to eat. It felt like someone was inside of me pushing the food back up. I thought giving up and dying from the stigmatized virus would be easier than waking up each day to fight for my life. My mother stayed with me in the hospital for a week. Then she supported me through 2 weeks of home treatment. Her support inspired me to get better for my loved ones, even if I didn't feel worthy of living anymore. Two months later, I arrived to campus as a college freshman. I was 50 pounds heavier, with a 90-day prescription of meds and a lot of angst. I had to remember to take my medicine, keeping me alive. I also had to make sure every meal was balanced and that I exercised regularly. This seemed tedious on top of adjusting to school, with its predominantly white spaces, rigorous courses, and a suffocating new social environment. I was afraid to take my medicine at dinner because I knew my friends would question me. Most of them were Black. I was aware of the stigma and stereotypes thrown on those in our community living with HIV. I'm gay and HIV positive. I knew my identity as a Black man would be under attack. So I struggled with being my authentic self in the first few months of college. But the more I accepted myself and my health improved, I started feeling comfortable taking my pills in front of my friends. One night at my crew's normal 7 o'clock dinner, someone new came and sat with us. I took my pill out, ready to take it. The new girl asked, "What do you take your medicine for, Caleb?" I told her, "I have HIV," and I swallowed the stigma along with my pill. I was finally able to open up to my friends, and I found support among them. The presidential election was a wake-up call. I realized I needed to be strong, not just for myself, but for all people of color. I started hosting workshops on sex positivity and healthy relationships. I also decided to run for a seat on student government. Other students of color were also mobilizing. We collaborated to reach voters and get people out to debates. That's how we made history. People of color are now in the majority of our executive board for student government. My story is one of redemption and victory, not shame. I went into college thinking I'd be dead by the end of my first semester, and I still wake up each day reminding myself, I'm worthy of living, and so are you.
That was Caleb Anderson. He wrote a version of the story for Vox Teen Communications and for Atlanta Magazine. To remind himself to take his medication, Caleb sets his phone alarm to Magnolia by Playboy Cardi. Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.